Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and welcome to Studio 471, which is our regular video interview series on cybersecurity and cyber threat intelligence. The discussions and products in underground markets and forums can give clues to how cyber criminals are exploiting and profiting from systems. But these markets can be quite sprawling, and extracting useful data can be difficult. With me today is Michele Campobasso, who's a cybercrime researcher at Eindhoven University of Technology. He's written an entire thesis around these problems and is here today to have a discussion about it. Thank you very much for joining me, Michele.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
So I think a good point to start with this conversation is to talk about what we in CTI call cybercrime as a service. What does this refer to, and what gave rise to it?
Sure. With cybercrime as a service, we refer to a paradigm where attackers get access to a service on a subscription basis rather than to the underlying product. And there are a few reasons that contribute to the rise of the cybercrime as a service economy. So for a seller, selling a product comes with the risk of losing intellectual property. So for example, a customer could repackage and resell the malware the seller worked so hard for a fraction of the price, thus limiting their revenue. So instead of doing a one-time sale of the complete source code of the malware, the seller can offer cheap subscriptions of durable of variable duration, thus accessing to a larger pool of customers with less spending capacity. And as an effect, cybercrime as a service gained momentum because it significantly lowered the barrier to wannabe criminals, giving them access to mature offensive capabilities at a fraction of their actual cost and enabling them to perform offensive operations. And finally, some are just byproducts of other attacks. Thanks to the scale economy in that sector too, new products emerged. So for example, you could build a botnet from systems that you already breached into for other reasons, thus maximizing the return on the investment for that compromised system.
Now, I think people may not quite understand sort of how organized these marketplaces are. Can you sort of describe how these markets and forums are, how do they organize their products then for visitors and potential buyers?
Yeah. So basically, those marketplaces oftentimes are organized in underground forums, and they are literally your not bulletin, but like a forum platform where you have like banter sections. You have most likely a section where you can introduce yourself. But the most important part is the marketplace section, where there is the chance to sellers to advertise their products, buyers to ask for some, and interact with the sellers in there. And maybe more importantly, many of those marketplaces also host a dispute resolution system where buyers and sellers can try to find an agreement when they are in disagreement about something that they try to buy or sell, and the market administrators acting as moderators in the conversation. So it's actually literally a forum, and some of the conversations, especially in the last sections, are quite fun to read, frankly.
And that's interesting, right? Because they built their own trust mechanisms just as you would in other online marketplaces too, right? There's like reviews, there's like escrow, because a lot of these people are criminals, right? But they still
Yeah,
need to trust each other, right?
indeed. That's a very important topic because differently from traditional crime, where contract enforcement is achieved by the use of force, in this ecosystem you are facing just a moniker of someone that wants to sell you something. You may decide that you want to buy that something, but eventually you're left with nothing in your hand. So you want to buy some credit cards that are allegedly have, I don't know, $1,000 in them. You buy those credit cards, but when you get them, they're most likely expired or they don't have the set amounts of money. So it's tricky. It's tricky in here. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, as I said in the opening there, that observing these markets, you can really see what's hot, what's not, what are the things that are sort of in demand. From an observational standpoint, which is what you studied, what are some of the challenges around looking at these forums, intelligence collection, I guess, obstacles?
Yeah, so one of the most pernicious problems here is the scale of the ecosystem. So having a stable foothold in multiple communities is time-consuming and resource-intensive, and may require also infiltration strategies that are tailored for the specific community. So cultivating personas, posing as legitimate customer can be very complicated, especially in some of the high-profile marketplaces, some of the more mature ones that we maybe we'll touch upon later. So making new account with a fantasy name on some of those communities will almost certainly lead to a rejection. And especially this happens in the Russian ecosystem, where communities are more mature and rely on relation between different marketplaces. So you're often required to refer to your profile in affiliated communities to prove your identity and your intentions. So if you are a practitioner, you want to get a foothold in those forums, the first step you have to do is to gain reputation on more open marketplaces. You have to build a little bit of a reputation there. Once you can convincingly pose as a legitimate customer and obtain access to that market, then you also have to keep the account alive. So managing to get an account is not enough per se, because you can be banned just for inactivity or just because you look too suspicious or you don't do are not doing any trading here. But now you are in the marketplace, okay? So once you manage to be in the marketplace, you want to extract some of the actionable CTI to defend your customers. So the more accounts you manage, the more coverage you have, but the more work you have to do on a daily basis to keep your accounts alive. And this is just unsustainable. I can tell that from the experience that I had during my research. It's really unsustainable. Therefore, we need crawlers. And but alas, market administrators know that law enforcement industry researchers use crawlers, so they ban them. But although it's not easy to do, it is possible to crawl those communities. There are a number of challenges that you do have to take into account when you try to scrape those markets.
Yeah, and you, as part of your PhD, you designed a crawler, threat crawl, to overcome some of those issues. Tell me about what you designed and then how it, I guess, overcomes those issues.
Yeah. So the idea was that we wanted to make a crawler that doesn't look like a crawler. And to do that, we achieved that by creating a human behavior model, and we embedded it into the crawler. Very simply put, we modeled a human that may have needs dictated by being a living being. So taking breaks, some of them are just random, some of them are longer, maybe they are around the time of usual meals. And all the while not following any strict schedule, being quite random. So the crawler has the freedom to take breaks every now and then. Another aspect that we model is that the crawler won't work the same way every time. So during the week, a person, usually even a cybercriminal, may have a daily job routine. So weekends might be more free. Some weekends just are not available for doing any interesting activity in the community. Finally, maybe those may sound a bit obvious, but we throttle traffic
Yep.
because differently from computers, which are efficient in extracting information, we as humans are not. We take time to read things. We need to decide what we want to look at, to click, to open, and we do that with multiple patterns of navigation that we took also in account. And a little bit on the technical side of things, yet another not so obvious thing, but we saw from at least from research it was not, that is that crawlers, humans use browsers to navigate the internet and not command line tools. This actually generates different HTTP traffic patterns. This could be an easy red flag to detect from market operators of a crawler activity.
So kind of low and slow in a way.
Yeah. So also, apart from the human modeling aspect, we want also to threat crawl to be useful for CTI researchers. So to accelerate the development of a crawler on a new forum, threat crawl also offers the operators a guided procedure to learn how to navigate a new forum, thus recognizing what are the parts of a web page within the forum to navigate, what are the things to click, what are the things to save. and overall how to interact and save information from the market. The software is open source and is directly linked in the Threat Scroll paper that I wrote. And unfortunately for the practitioners out there that are already cloning the repository, I have to tell you that the software is not stable in the current release. We tested the crawler against seven forums. The training part was quite successful, while the crawling part was not that much for a number of reasons. And as it stands right now, we know that some of the capabilities of it, like bypassing captures from Cloudflare, is no longer working. But yeah, it needs a little bit more of more development in right now to employ it in production.
Sure, absolutely, as any new software would. I'm gonna link to Michele's paper as well, so you can see that in the show notes. I want to talk a little bit about Genesis Market because this was a really significant underground market that was quite popular, selling packages, selling bots, basically packages of kind of like compromised machines. It was disrupted in May 2023 by law enforcement. What did we learn from Genesis about what cyber criminals prefer and how they operate?
Yeah, so we learned basically that Genesis to provide the product they were selling, they were relying themselves on cybercrime as a service products as well. So to gather the bots, those packages of stolen information, they were relying on large scale malware infections with malvertisement, paper install, and exploitation as a service, traffers. We found evidence in affiliated communities that they were sourcing those tools as well. But then looking at on what they were supplying, looking at the distribution of the product, we learned that Genesis was a worldwide threat targeting predominantly first world countries. And they were excluding also CIS countries, which is quite common in Russian cybercrime. When we were looking at supply and demand, also we noticed that the supply from North America and Oceania were almost completely absorbed, despite the EU being very abundant as a supply. And this strong preference may indicate that attackers found more lucrative to defraud profiles originating from North America and Oceania, perhaps due to a more lax regulation on strong authentication of financial institutions. Furthermore, we learned that attackers preferred fresh profiles harvested within few days. And as a matter of fact, attackers know that credentials may be reset after a malware detection, lowering their chances of successful exploitation. So, from a defendant point of view, this teaches us that being in the underground, like some credentials of your internal systems being out there, doesn't necessarily translate into a threat. In this case, we noticed that profiles advertised for more than a few days were very unlikely to be sold, and threat will never materialize in that case. So, therefore, monitoring market activity can teach us how the attackers think, and this can help also to prioritize a little bit intervention in case of increased risk.
So it's fresh credentials, right? At a certain
Yeah.
level of threat actors want them freshly harvested, I guess.
Yeah, because if you think Genesis was working on some sort of a subscription-based model. When you were buying a bot, when you were buying that, you were buying the subscription to an infected system that was going to send you updated credentials, updated cookies over time. If the malware is detected, the subscription doesn't work anymore because you're not anymore connected to the victim, and therefore credentials are more likely to be reset over time, or cookies are going to expire.
Yeah, interesting. Let's talk about just so sorting out high quality markets from, I guess, lower quality markets from a CTI collection perspective. Your dissertation discusses issues that are typical of, like, you call it markets for lemons. What does that mean, and what are some of the traits of sophisticated markets?
Yeah, that is a definition that an economy researcher called Akerlof in the 70s came up with. Lemons are the bad cars that you can buy from the second-hand car market. So market for lemons are basically markets that suffer information asymmetry, which means that basically sellers have more information about the product they're selling, and buyers have no means to tell what is the product that they actually need. Okay, so Let's make this interactive with a practical example. So, Jeremy, you want to buy a secondhand car. You find two cars from brand X, model A, same year from two sellers. Seller A says that their car has 50,000 kilometers, has been checked last month, all fluids have been changed, and price is $10,000. Seller B says that their car has 80,000 kilometers, has a small defect to the clutch, which needs to be changed shortly, and last check was done 1 year ago. The price is 100,000. $11,000. So, which one would you buy?
Oh, that's tough. I'll go with A. I'm gonna go with I'm gonna trust the seller. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't.
No. I mean, it has less kilometers. It has been serviced and everything. Why shouldn't you? So, you purchase that car. However, after a few hundred kilometers, what happens is that brakes and tires are worn, the engine overheats easily. So when you go to your trusted mechanic, it says that actually the car actually has 120,000 kilometers and you need to
Oh.
pay to repair the car. That's quite horrible. So next time, I'm not sure if you will buy again a secondhand car, would you? Probably
No,
not.
yeah.
So consider that problem happening on a systematically, you know? So you buy something and it turns out not to be what you wanted to buy, okay? So buyers are no longer going to be interested in joining the secondhand car market because you don't trust the sellers in the market. And to compete with sellers, what adds insult to injury, to compete with these dishonest sellers, the honest sellers will have to lower their prices by reducing then their margin that they're going to make on top of that, and then will eventually leave the market because it's going to be unsustainable for them to be there.
Interesting, interesting. So from a collection standpoint, I guess, how do you figure out then which ones are the ones that are, not waste, you don't want to waste your time on, and but which ones have innovative, I guess, offensive products?
To connect back, the thing is that we have to see those markets that manage to address and mitigate those problems of quality uncertainty. And basically, we conducted an investigation on more than 20 underground markets we had access to, and we learned that on average, mature markets are able to establish trust and promote the innovative products on average have strict seller verification. They verify basically their sellers by trying their products, making them to pay for their advantage position in the market to sell their products. Also, administrators are not actively involved in trade, so they are just acting as mere facilitators of the market. They are the people that police in the market because they have maybe the incentive from the fees that sellers are paying, the fees from transactions happening in here. So they have already the revenue stream. They don't want to mess with the market. They want to make it nice and fair for everyone. And finally, also, they tend to be more segregated. Those are in general markets that is harder to get access to. Those are not markets like free access ones. Those are markets that require you to receive a voucher from someone. You have to identify yourself from affiliated communities. And when you combine also these countermeasures together that you have to buy for getting like access to more segregated sections of the market, and you have to undergo scrutineering, that you may blow up completely your identity over multiple marketplaces, these become very effective ways to control who is in the market and to improve the quality of the products being traded therein.
Yeah. How do you assess the, there's been lots of law enforcement actions. We mentioned Genesis earlier. There's been other ones against big marketplaces. How do you assess the impact of those actions? And is that a good strategy going forward as to, or is it like the war on drugs, right? Where an absence of something creates demand?
Differently with the war on drugs, here we are in the situation where I mean, drugs could be maybe regulated in other ways, but here you cannot really regulate the theft of stolen credit cards. So, criminologists, if you're looking just at this self-organized cybercrime that is not state-sponsored, we see, for example, that criminologists and sociologists have been experimenting a little bit with the effects of deterrence in teenagers that may begin their career in hacking by buying booter services to disrupt the game that they are losing in League of Legends or whatever other MOBA game you can think of, and results are quite promising. So in the Netherlands, there are joint efforts between academia and law enforcement to create workshops and activities for young people to teach them how to do hacking the legal way and to show how cool is it. And because after all, we have to remember that criminals are they're just people. It's just people like us. They're curious, they seek for recognition from their peers. They don't even perceive sometimes that what they're doing is illegal because maybe they're just very young and they want to do just a cool thing, right? So I believe that informing new generations about the risks and giving them the possibility to learn cool stuff is the right path to take to tackle cybercrime on a systematic level.
Just curious about the use of sort of end-to-end encryption. I know that when Telegram announced that it would be, I guess, cooperate more with law enforcement after Pavel Durov was arrested in France, that we noticed some threat actors saying we're going to kind of move away from Telegram. I mean, we haven't done any sort of quantifiable studies of if there's more or less sort of offerings on there. I mean, so Telegram still seems to be thriving as far as a marketplace. I mean, do you think that, the era of the large sort of, clear web forum like breach forums may give way to smaller groups using end-to-end encryption for better OPSEC? But I guess on the other side, that may not offer as large of a market either. Where do you see this going?
That's very on point actually, and especially when you talk about the Telegram case, I don't think the reason why Telegram is really used is about OPSEC, or at least maybe some of the players are not really that aware that it is not really the case maybe anymore. But it might be also a practical means to conduct some sort of trade, to trade some kind of products, because Telegram, for example, has bots that allow you to do auto shops for proxies or infrastructure. Credit cards also, I spotted something about that, but is less common, frankly. But the bottom line here seems to be that sold products are cheaper on average than what you can find on forums, or at least less sophisticated than others. And so also we notice basically that from underground forums there is some spillover effect for some specific kind of products, it could be just a way to cut costs, for example. With bots, it is very convenient to buy proxies, for example, and it could be an opportunity for someone dealing with infrastructure to just use the Telegram APIs to feed in the new proxies that you can buy by just running a script. It's very convenient in that regard, but still the problem remains. I mean, how do you mitigate quality uncertainty? How do you make sure that what you're buying is not fluff and is actually something that you really want to buy? And one may argue that spending a few dollars to buy proxies of an unknown quality is acceptable because you can do it easily with your phone, or you can funnel it into your infrastructure. But are you going to spend thousands of dollars to buy leaks or malware like the top-notch one? I don't know. Uses of Telegram look different, also. Apart from product, there is also room for activism, politically motivated actors. And maybe it's just a matter of what is being traded here, you know? I have this impression, frankly, that is more of a different venue with a different audience doing different things. So from a defender perspective, it really depends on what is the stakeholders you're trying to protect. What is the framing of your defensive operations?
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Mikolay, for joining me. Like I said earlier, we're going to link to his dissertation in the show notes so you can check that out. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy. It was a pleasure.